cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
For a long time, biotech was a hot investment as venture capital firms and investors really generally poured tons of money into startups in the industry. Tim, it's a bit different today.
Yeah, this especially as VC investments are on track for the sharpest drop in more than two decades, surpassing the declines of the dot-com crash and the financial crisis. So the question is, what's a biotech startup to do? This story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it's on newsstands tomorrow, already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg. With more, we've got Bloomberg News healthcare reporter Angelica Peebles on Zoom from Boston, along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber. He's right here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So Joel, we saw VC investment really dry up in 2022 compared to 2021. The biotech VC investment in the US and the UK really dried up as well.
So and, what is it? And here comes 2023.
Exactly. That's the question. What's a biotech to do?
Yeah. Hoard your cash and, then hoard it some more and find ways to make that cash grow if you can. Confession, I reached out while Angelica was at the JP Morgan Healthcare Conference in San Francisco recently. And my thesis was, boy, the tech industry going through some stuff. Maybe biotech is going to be the big winner here. And turns out no, right, Angelica? What'd you learn while you were out there?
That's exactly right, Joel. Unfortunately, biotech is taking a pretty big hit, just like tech stocks and other risky assets in this environment where people are looking for safe havens. And this really started last year. 2021 ushered in this huge wave of euphoria. Everyone was looking for the next Moderna and trying to invest in a hot new biotech company. And unfortunately, that changed last year. We saw a steep drop in venture funding, and we're seeing it in the public markets too, where the stocks are down pretty significantly and everyone's just looking for ways to spend their money wisely. And that means that companies are having to get creative on what they do with their money.
So what's the conversation like with VCs? Like when you were there, and what's put your finger on the pulse, what's the vibe?
So it's interesting because I speak to a lot of specialist VCs and they say that nothing's changed fundamentally. There's still a lot of great companies. There's a lot of great science out there, and that actually we kind of needed a reset because there were so many companies that were getting started and easily finding money, and that it led to sort of this overheated market where anyone could get, you could fund a company based on a dream rather than data. So they're not really upset to see this. Of course, if you're a company that's can't find money, that's a bigger problem for you. And there's always the risk that even the good companies won't be able to fundraise in this environment.
So I like the idea that, you know, there's a silver lining to this, that there's an opportunity here. I'm wondering if you got the sense from some of these folks you talked to out at the JP Morgan conference in San Francisco that this is part of a normal economic cycle, or if this downturn is any different.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people say, especially the VCs. They've been through these cycles before. It typically happens where there's a boom and a bust. And it's nothing new. However, there are some differences this time around. There's this big new law, the Inflation Reduction Act, that could cap drug prices in a few years, and people are wondering what exactly that will mean. We're already hearing from some pharma companies that they are looking at potentially less lucrative valuations for companies that they might invest in, partner with, or eventually acquire. So that's an unknown. And also, we're coming off this period where valuations were so hot, and you know, how will companies go moving forward? One person I talked to described it as this sugar rush, and now that sugar rush is over, and it's really a new playbook. Yeah, that's definitely not a good thing.
Maybe there needs to be some sort of like pharmaceutical to prevent a desire for sugar. I don't know.
Angelica, I do wonder though. You know, a lot of money sometimes it gets used recklessly when it's really kind of loose and money's cheap. But at the same time, it also provides open opportunities, I feel like, for developments that really can change the way we're treated, whether it's healthcare or modalities. And I do wonder, if the money isn't so easy, does it mean biotech really has to think hard about what they're going to work on? And maybe that's not great for innovation.
Definitely. We saw this boom of platform companies, as they like to call themselves. So companies that were working on many different diseases or all kinds of areas, as opposed to just one drug for one disease. And that was sort of the hot theme of 2021. And this year already, we're seeing the theme is prioritized. So one company, Editas, they're based here in Boston, the Boston area, and they said that they would stop the work that they've been doing on eye diseases and instead focus on blood disorders. And you're seeing that across the board, whether they're public companies or private. People are focusing on only the most important diseases or the drugs that have the biggest probability of success.
Right.
And of course, that means that those other diseases, those other patients who are waiting for medicines for their diseases, are going to have to wait.
Okay, so things not good here. How what do they look like in the UK compared to here or anywhere else, just to get a sense of what the industry feels like around the world?
Across the board, we saw funding dip this year, or 2022 compared to 2021. So it's not only the U.S., but of course, the U.S. and a lot of the companies I cover are focused here. And so that's why particularly we're focused on what's happening in this part of the world.
Okay, so Angelica, if the dominant theme over the last few years has been vaccines, what's kind of the most exciting thing to come out of, or that biotech companies are thinking about right now?
There's a lot of exciting stuff out there, so it's hard to pick exactly specific areas, but some of the ones that we have been talking to a lot of people about are obesity. People are really, really focused on that. I mean, you think about how many people are out there. That could have a huge impact on public health, and of course could be a very lucrative area for drug makers. So we heard a lot of companies focused on obesity at the conference this year. An area that I'm really interested in as well is gene therapy. So taking genetic diseases and actually potentially curing them by making permanent changes to someone's DNA. It sounds a little bit like science fiction, but it's actually reality. And then we're also seeing a lot of new technologies in cancer. So we spoke to one company, Seagen, that's been at the forefront of a type of cancer drug called an ADC. And we spoke to their new CEO, who said that they're going to keep working on that. And they're also looking for lots of new technology. So it's a busy time out there.
I actually think that the sector as a whole is, again, just like, one little big hit away from like everybody feeling like, it's great. Let's go back in.
I think
and, the big difference here versus like tech is it's so solutions oriented. Like all these things are people, things that affect millions of people, right? It just ends up being a little bit of a crapshoot in terms of what the ROI can look like.
I totally agree, right? Like these developments. Such great reporting, such great insight. Angelica, thank you so much. Angelica Peebles, healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News via Zoom from Boston. Check out this story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands tomorrow, online already, and on the Bloomberg Terminal. Our thanks always to Jill Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, as you know, the World Economic Forum's annual meeting at Davos, it continues. We've heard from a lot of politicians. Well, not too many, because a lot of them, I think, held back because of concerns about the war and some of the political stories going on around the world. But also executives, investors, bankers, corporate types, academics, even former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers.
Yeah, he highlighted brightening aspects for the global economy, but also warned U.S. political battles over the debt ceiling are a concern. Also there, lots of corporate executives. And Bloomberg Quick Take correspondent Madison Mills joins us now via Zoom from Davos. Madison, good to have you with us this afternoon for us, this evening for you. First of all, what are you seeing? What are you hearing on the ground at Davos?
Hey, guys, thank you so much for having me. Great to chat with you. You know, it's a lot of the same things that are always on the agenda here at Davos. I was lucky enough to come here over the summer, and it's eerily similar, talking about, of course, that war in Ukraine, the Russian invasion there, and the big economy question, right? Are we going to have a recession in 2023? One thing that's been really interesting is hearing how cautiously optimistic people are. Citi's CEO, Jane Fraser, talked with David Westin, our very own, yesterday, and she said she's very optimistic about the recession being short and not that deep because she's really betting on U.S. households maintaining their own balance sheets in the face of that high services inflation that we are seeing. So interesting to hear that kind of positive tone from a lot of the CEOs at Davos, while, you know, we report all the time on individuals back in the U.S. who are still struggling with those incredibly high prices on things like eggs. You know, I was at the grocery store here in Davos tonight and noticed that eggs are actually the only thing that's cheaper in Switzerland that I can
find. Are you kidding?
It's, I mean, the prices here, Carol, would blow your mind. It's incredibly expensive. But eggs, I think because of, I'm not 100% on this, but I think because the avian flu impact is lower in Europe than it is in the U.S., only $5 for a dozen eggs in Switzerland. It's the only thing I could find that's cheaper here.
You know, I do feel like, Maddie, like some of these big events that brings leaders from different walks of life, politicians, the corporate community, you know, all kinds of, you know, think tanks, academics, just like something like a Milken or some other events. I do wonder, you know, what the major trends are beyond the overall mood and thought. You know, what are you picking up on? You're someone who really, like, you know, kind of seizes on some of the interesting innovations that are going on there. What are you seeing?
Yeah, you know, one story that I feel like isn't necessarily making headlines that I'm hearing a lot of the CEOs and decision makers talk about sort of off the record is this idea and sort of this anger towards younger employees and the people who are a little bit hesitant to get back to work. we heard from our Bloomberg Opinions, Allison Schrager. She's moderating a ton of panels this week. And she also told me that she was speaking with executives from Sony yesterday who all just said, you know, even in countries where a high work ethic across all age ranges is really valued, they're starting to have a lot of trouble getting younger employees in the office. And they're also experiencing a lot of ghosting. So Gen Z employees will sign contracts at these companies and then just won't show up for their first day of work and will never contact the company again. So I'm really hearing a lot of anger from CEOs about younger employees not getting back to work and not necessarily working as hard.
But does that lead to a shift, Maddie, in the way that companies are thinking about compensation or the way that companies are thinking about work. I mean, certainly that's not the theme of Davos this year, but getting people back to the office is certainly a theme here in the United States, and we're seeing it from a lot of individual companies. Is that discussion happening at all?
I think it's critical. And I feel like quiet quitting is also something that's coming up a lot. But what's interesting is at the same time, they're talking about the struggles with younger employees, but then they talk about also needing to source young employees and this kind of dichotomy of like, I'm struggling to get them in the office, but I also genuinely want to hire younger people and want to involve them. So it's interesting to kind of hear that struggle there. I spoke with the CEO of Ernst & Young earlier today, Carmine DeCivio, and one thing that he pointed out that was a lesson to me was that he's not necessarily seeing a huge amount of talent emerging from all of those big tech layoffs that we talk about. He was saying he's still struggling to get coders and engineers in the door. And he feels like if the layoffs were as bad as they potentially seem like they are, he wouldn't be struggling as much to get that talent. So I thought that was also really, really interesting.
All right, everybody. We're talking to Bloomberg Quick Take correspondent Madison Mills. She is in Davos, Switzerland for the World Economic Forum annual meeting, which is being held again in the winter for the first time. Was it, Maddie, 3 years that this is because of the pandemic? It's a long time. One thing I want to get to, and it's something you guys at Quick Take cover a lot. I know Tim covers it, loves it, and that has to be anything to do with space. And you caught up with a particular CEO. Give us a little bit of background about Dylan Taylor and his company.
Yeah, Dylan Taylor is, and Tim, I can't wait to talk to you about this when I'm back because I feel like you would love this guy. Dylan Taylor runs Space Voyager. They do a lot of investment and get investment in the future of commercial space travel. And he really believes something that some people push back against here at Davos, the idea that commercial space travel is just as good for the climate as anything we can do on Earth. He was lucky enough to be able to go to space as part of one of Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin trips. And he said that overview effect is really critical and real, that when you're able to look down at planet Earth, it can just change your life and change your perspective and make you realize the importance of climate. I think we have some sound from Dylan Taylor that I want us to take a listen to.
I think the biggest space story in 2023, just to pick a couple, I think we'll likely get another all-private astronaut mission to the space station. So that'll be an important milestone. But probably the most important would be SpaceX making orbit, hopefully, with their new Starship, which is their new generation rocket, which if it works and if it makes orbit, which I believe it will, it could completely change the game and reduce the launch costs by another order of magnitude.
So, of course, my follow-up question was, are you concerned at all about Elon Musk and the impact he could have on the potential of future space travel coming out of SpaceX? And he said he's not concerned at all, that there are a lot of executives at SpaceX doing a lot of great work who are not related to Elon Musk in any way. So he's really optimistic about SpaceX and the impact SpaceX could have on space travel heading into this year.
Yeah, I mean, what it's shown, Maddie, is that private companies can now do what governments were only able to do just a few years ago. And I think it's remarkable to see the private investment in the industry. Of course, these companies, we should remember, still rely on government contracts for much of the funding. So it is still taxpayer money that is supporting many of these launches. But at the same time, it's remarkable to see, Carol, what the private sector has done.
Yeah, I think about it. You know, you guys have heard it. When my dad was involved in the 60s, you know, in the space program, it was all government run and government initiatives. And it's really, I think he'd be fascinated to see, you know, the role of the private sector so aggressively and so successfully, Maddie, you know, really carrying the baton, if you will. And I think it's a good thing, you know, moving it out of the government sector and the public sector.
Yeah, it's so interesting. He wants to fund and build the first commercial space station. And he really believes in the ability for that to exist alongside a government-funded space station as well. His point is like, why not have multiple going on up there, you know? So it's really interesting to see and something that I'm excited for us to continue to cover.
All right, Maddie, before we let you go, I want to talk a little crypto. We did report, the Bloomberg News team, that the crypto firm Genesis is said to plan a bankruptcy filing. Could come sometime this week, according to our team here at Bloomberg News. What are you hearing on the ground there about crypto regulation, just in the last minute that we have with you?
You know, Tim, I can't tell if it's just kind of talk because it's something that people can agree on. It's not a super partisan topic, but everyone seems really excited to talk about crypto regulation and agree on the idea that regulation is needed. But I haven't heard anyone talk about crypto being dead. I was able to speak with the chief policy officer of Coinbase, and he met with the congressional delegation of DC lawmakers who are here at Davos and pitched the same thing to them, that it was, you know, a bad actor in Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX, but the industry is not bad. And so he's really hopeful that crypto is going to have a rebound in 2023.
All right, what's a cup of coffee cost? What's a latte cost? Come on.
I got an iced coffee when I landed, Carol.
Yes.
It was $9. Oh. $9. $9.
It is Switzerland.
I am saving those receipts, you guys. It is really tough.
When your boss is like, come on, Maddie, what is this?
I'm so sorry to my bosses in advance.
All right, looking forward to more of your reporting. Of course, our Maddie Mills of Bloomberg Quick Take on the ground in Davos, Switzerland at the World Economic Forum. You can catch all of our coverage. Just head to Bloomberg.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
We've got a great guest with us, a well-known voice for the investment community and certainly the Bloomberg audience. Howard Marks is with us, the co-chairman, co-founder of Oaktree Capital Group, known for his investing in distressed securities. The firm has some $163 billion in assets under management. He joins Tim and myself here in our Interactive Brokers studio. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. How are you?
Doing well. Looking at your research, we looked over it, and I've got to say, it's all about sea change. I'm a sailor, and I know, and I have been for years, sea change. It can be a good thing, and it can be a bad thing. Tell us about your thinking here.
Well, the point is that a sea change is something more fundamental than a minor cyclical fluctuation. It suggests a total transformation that will be somewhat long-lasting. And the
doesn't
point,
happen often.
And by definition, it doesn't happen often. But the point of the memo was that ever since the global financial crisis, the Fed put in emergency measures to rescue the economy and the markets, and they worked. But they were continued for a long time. Zero rates were the rule for 7 years, which I was stunned to find out when I researched it, and that kind of conditioned the markets to depend on ultra-low rates, which was unrealistic. And then when they tried in 16, 17, 18 to raise rates, they got a lot of pushback. The fourth quarter of 18, you may recall, they took the 10-year to the Fed funds rate hit 3.25, and the fourth quarter of 18 was the worst fourth quarter in history as a consequence. So they were in a low return trap. Mm-hmm. And lenders likewise were in a low return trap. You know, I gave a speech for 8 years entitled Investing in a Low Return World, and it wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. Because how do you get a good return in a low return world? You either accept the low returns or you take on more risk to try to get a high return, and that may not be a great idea either. So there is no easy out, and we labored in the wilderness for a decade with low yields prevalent, and I think that that's not going to be the case to the same degree going forward.
It's not just, you know, low yields not being prevalent as being part of this sea change. What else do you see? Which, by the way, you argue this is only the third sea change you've seen in your career.
Yes. Well, in the 70s, I saw the adoption of risk return thinking. You know, before that, a professional money manager or fiduciary, the rules were this is okay to do, this is not okay to do. But with the advent of high yield bond issuance in the late 70s, people started to think, well, it may be risky, but I'm well paid to do it, so I'm going to do it. It makes sense. And that has become the rule and been the rule ever since. And I think that was a very good change. Most of the things that we see in the financial world today are the result of that calculus. Then in the early 80s, of course, to fight the inflation that was prevalent in the U.S. reaching mid-teens, Volcker took the Fed funds rate to 20, and that eventually killed off inflation and inflationary expectations. It kind of killed the economy in the process, But then, you know, I had a loan outstanding from a bank in 80, and I got a slip saying the rate is now 22 and a quarter. 40 years later, I was able to borrow money at 2 and a quarter. So we had a 2,000 basis point decline in interest rates, and that was a major event. That was probably the biggest single financial event of the last half century, but nobody talks about it.
Howard, one thing I want to ask you, and it's in your research note, you know, you talk about, you know, when you see both rising asset values as well as a very low rate environment and what that does in terms of leverage. Tell us how that maybe creates, ultimately, I'm assuming, opportunities for you.
Ultimately, we hope. But, you know, look, the government doesn't make anything. It doesn't add to GDP. It doesn't create anything. All it does is takes money in and puts money out. And it policy benefits some and hurts others. So the policies of the last 14 years that I'm talking about benefited asset owners and borrowers and penalized lenders and savers. But it was a boon for anybody who owned assets and for anybody who borrowed. And what about people who did both, who owned assets on borrowed money? A double bonanza. You know, the problem is that, A, the success of that depends somewhat on the persistence of that environment. And number two, environments that produce high profits usually encourage people to push the limits further and to go out and do riskier things because of the absence of risk aversion, which usually ends up badly. You know, we've gone through an easy period for the last 14 years.
It's going to be different now.
And I believe that the coming period will be a harder period. Not a cataclysm, not a depression, but, you know, I think that people don't recognize that the last 14 years have been unusually easy, and that I believe that the coming years will not be similarly easy.
So it opens up the question about where specifically you would see opportunities for distressed debt in 2023 and beyond.
Sure. Well, first of all, I think we might see some, and that would be a change. You know, in the very benevolent environment that we had over that period, it was very hard to default. It was very hard to go bankrupt. In fact, you had to have something seriously wrong to do that, because most companies that just burned money every quarter could borrow more.
We just talked about the biotech sector, that it's been an easy 10 years for them.
Yes.
But
when risk aversion rears its head and you go in to get more, now somebody might say, you know what, you're just burning money. We're not going to give you any more.
So where in I think it was November, you talked with our team and you said great bargains coming as recession looms. Mm. So where specifically? I know we've been, you know, is it energy? Is it real estate? Is it – where is it?
Well, you know I'd never get down to that granular level. And our activities are kind of not planned. We're opportunistic. Fair. When something pops up and some company has to roll over its debt and suddenly is unable, you know, we mobilize. You know, the point is we're not laying plans in advance.
Well, do we take something like Elon Musk and all the debt he took on for Twitter? Mm. Do we take a Bed Bath & Beyond, another retailer falling to the wayside? I'm trying to think.
Party City.
I feel like,
I mean, you could name any crypto firm over the last 6 weeks.
Are these signs that are playing to what you're talking about?
Well, let me just say, without getting too specific, which I always try to avoid.
I know, sorry.
That's okay. That our mantra is good company, bad balance sheet. A good company that has gotten over levered and that leverage level has turned out to be excessive for the environment that has unfolded, you can fix that by delevering the company. Maybe you take it through a bankruptcy in which you reject a lot of debt. But it's easy to, if you can delever a good company, it goes on to success, or certainly it's reinstated. Bad companies are hard to fix, as opposed to a good company with bad balance sheets. So you propose the list. You figure out which companies on that list, are important to stay in business for the next 10 years.
You mentioned a couple retailers, Carol, which makes me question if there are any industries or sectors you would avoid.
Historically, We're okay with retail,
okay.
Although one has to be cognizant of the changing business model. We're mostly active in what I would call the basic industries, the traditional industries, the ones with assets.
Like energy?
Like energy, yes. Manufacturing, distribution, transportation, even retail. Under the right circumstances. Where we historically have not been active has been, for example, technology, because there you need a higher level of expertise with regard to the subject matter,
right?
Intellectual property, style, fashion, things like that.
This environment, this sea change, we only have about 30 seconds left. How long does it stay with us in your view? Because as you say, these don't happen a lot, but they do stick around.
I don't make forecasts, and I don't believe forecasts, especially my own. Having said that, I'm not talking about 6 months or a year, and I don't ever venture a thought to 10 years. So I would say something in between. But, I mean, this is material, and I would say a few or several years.
Well, and I do feel like it mirrors some of the conversations we've had, that this low-rate environment, we have a generation who's never seen anything but. Right.
Could we see a fourth sea change in your career?
I hope I live long enough.
We hope you do, too.
Thank you.
Howard Marks, thank you so much for finding time
for
us.
Carol.
He's, of course, the co-chairman of Oaktree Capital Management.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
TikTok, everybody. 17 minutes left in today's trading session. It's been an interesting day, certainly on the equity front. Charlie, of course, breaking down the markets. But really, I think the story largely, and we've talked about this, is the disappointing economic news, Tim, and certainly the pressure that we've seen when it comes to rates. I mean, 10-year, 3.37 right now, 2-year note with a yield of 4.08. So we've really seen a move down when it comes to the rate picture.
Yeah, and it was kind of green until we saw that economic data hit at 10 a.m.
On equities, Carol. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
All right, so let's talk about it. Let's get to the drive to the close. Brian Frank is back with us, CIO at Frank Capital Partners here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. The Frank Value Fund up nearly 8% in the past month, putting it in the 91st percentile. According to our data, in the past 1 year, the fund gained 6.5%, so beating just about all of its peers. For the past 5 years, the fund has returned on average annually about 5%, again, according to our data. As you know, it's not been easy being a value guy, has it?
No, it's never easy, but the last 5 years were like fire and brimstone. It was a real test.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year. Is it going to be a happy year for value?
I think
we just
so,
talked
Carol.
To Howard Marks talking about sea changes in the investment environment. Don't happen often, but he's saying this low rate environment, people loading up on leverage, could potentially mean opportunities for him in the distressed area. What does it mean for value?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, to hear someone of Howard Marks' caliber say that, because that's what we've been thinking in the value shop as well. Like you said, it's been a miserable environment for value investors over the last few years. But in the early 2000s, 2001, 2002, it was the golden age. And that's what it feels like today, another golden age of value. You have rates going up, you have the growth companies suffering, and you have phenomenal value companies available, not only at good valuations, but many of them, at least in our fund, are less cyclical as well, because it looks like there's some pretty bad economic data on the horizon.
So if this is indeed, and I, you know, we talked to Howard Marks earlier about a quote-unquote sea change, if that is indeed happening, do you see the era of value continuing? I mean, is this a long-term bet, given that interest rates could be high for quite a while?
I think so. And it, even without those interest rates, I mean, the bond market clearly disagrees with the Fed right now. But in either direction, you're going to have trouble for growth companies. You're seeing layoffs at Microsoft today. I think Google and Facebook are actually cyclical advertising companies instead of technology companies.
Interesting.
And the market needs to figure that out and completely revalue those companies for what's ahead. But on the other side of the coin, energy, one of the best performers last year, is actually priced for recession. These companies are still very cheap, but they have much better balance sheets than in the past. I believe energy as a sector is going to have net cash pretty soon, if not already. And there's still a supply issue out there, even if we get demand destruction. So yes, I think the golden age of value is here and can continue.
What kind of positioning or repositioning have you been doing, if at all, Brian, in your portfolio?
We've slowly been selling some of those energy companies that have become fully valued, but we're still very overweight energy.
Mm-hmm.
Our best performer last year was H&R Block, which certainly is not an exciting company.
We've talked to their CEO several times.
Yeah, and we love what he's done with the place.
Yeah, they've been shifting, right, to much more be kind of a hub for individuals. And we're talking about not necessarily the high end, right? I feel like everybody goes back up to after wealth management, but kind of everyday people, right?
Yeah.
And the services that they need.
That's right. There's some meat in the middle there, and that's what H&R Block is going after. But it was a tremendous value about a year and a half ago. We're up about 150% on it, but we did actually take the gain last year not because of strategy or anything like that, which we totally agree with. It just became fully valued. And with a 4% risk-free rate now, there's a pretty high hurdle to investing in any kind of risk, in my opinion. So you have to choose your spots.
Well, so fixed income versus equity. Like, are you more inclined to play in that fixed income space because the yield not so shabby now?
We also do private wealth management, and we've definitely taken clients much towards the fixed income side as rates have come up. We've still kept duration tight, short, because...
Yeah.
There are still some pretty smart people out there saying that listen to the Fed and don't listen to the bond market. Maybe inflation will surprise on the upside. And with the value fund, we're about 80% invested, which is our maximum amount of cash.
Equity, though, right?
Largely equity. Yeah, that one has to be equities. That's typically 100% invested in equities. But we can hold some cash if there aren't opportunities there. And that cash is making 4%, which is great.
So where are you seeing opportunities on the equity side now?
We've recently have gotten into the restaurant business. I can't talk about a specific name there, but generally with restaurants, inflation really bit hard and they weren't able to raise their prices fast enough to cover those costs. But I think if you get some good operators there and some great brand names, they'll eventually catch up and those margins will come back. We're actually worried about margins as a whole for equities, especially going into a recession, but we think maybe the restaurant business can kind of buck that trend.
Tell us about your number one holding.
Our number one holding is something called Calumet Specialty Products, which you probably won't find in any other mutual fund. This is around a $2 billion company that essentially runs a refiner out of Montana, and they're converting their refinery to renewable diesel, and then after that, they're going to convert it to sustainable aviation fuel. So those types of green energy investments typically command a big multiple,
yeah,
because the majors want to buy them for the tax write-offs and for the carbon write-offs. And nobody's recognizing Calumet, probably because it's a limited partnership. Their actual core business is industrial lubricants, which isn't exactly exciting to talk about.
But necessary, right?
Certainly. And again, we're not making more of this stuff. We're not making more refineries. Calumet, as small as it is set up to be the biggest producer of sustainable aviation fuel over the next few years in the U.S. So it's a nice, interesting little market. And the valuation's pretty cheap on this thing. We love it.
Really appreciate it. Brian Frank, he's Chief Investment Officer at Frank Capital Partners. As we mentioned, that Frank Value Fund has been beating just about all of its peers in the past year, up about 6.5% in a year that we know, Tim, not many things were showing positive returns.
Yeah, S&P was down 20% last year, you know, and change.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.